You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm Stephen Hubble from the Open Society Fellowship Program. I'd like to welcome you to the offices of the Open Society Foundations. We're delighted to have such a good turnout. Before we start, let me just give a brief introduction. Sometime in the waning months of 1993, the British Defense Export Services Company began its long and elaborate courtship of the individuals who would shortly become the new South African defense establishment. Chief among those individuals was Joe Modise, who had recently stepped down as the head of the armed wing of the African National Congress. About 5 years later, give or take, those negotiations, that courtship, would culminate in an arms deal worth upwards of $7 billion U.S. dollars, and it would be accompanied by bribes to the tune of tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. The revelation of that arms deal and the implications of it for South African politics can only be described as explosive. Modise was tarred with his involvement in that corruption scandal for the rest of his life. He died, I think, in 2001. Another outcome of this, another consequence of this arms deal, is that it served as the inspiration for not one but two books by Andrew Feinstein. The first of those books was called After the Party, Corruption, the ANC, and South Africa's Uncertain Future. And it was a political memoir that chronicles his years as a South African parliamentarian, his investigation of this arms deal, his eventual resignation from the party and departure from South Africa for the UK. It's a wonderful book. It's a testament to courage and deep ethical convictions. I urge you to try to lay your hands on it if you can. The second book is obviously the occasion for us being here tonight. It's called The Shadow World, and you'll hear a great deal more about it soon. Much of it was researched and written while Andrew was an Open Society Fellow. And Andrew, in his capacity as a fellow, has taught us in this organization a great deal about the corrosive effects of the international arms trade on democratic accountability. And for this and many other reasons, we feel very privileged to have had him as an Open Society Fellow, and we're delighted to welcome him back to our offices tonight. We are equally privileged to have as his two partners on the so-called stage, two distinguished speakers, either one of whom would be an appropriate subject to have a similar event organized around and on behalf of. We have Jeff Abramson, who may be known to you as the coordinator of Control Arms Secretariat, a global civil society organization that is working to build support for an arms trade treaty, about which you'll hear more later. Kathy Austin may also be very well known to you as a crusading anti-arms trafficking, the person who tracks the arms traffickers. She is the executive director of the Conflict Awareness Project. You may also have followed her commentary about the Victor Boot trial, which concluded recently, on her indispensable blog, which is called Tracking Boot. And the verdict in that trial culminates a 15-year personal odyssey, as she puts it, to bring the notorious arms trader to justice. So we're delighted to welcome both of them, as well as Andrew, to our offices. Without further ado, many thanks to all of you and to our speakers.
Thanks very much, Steve. Can you hear me? Would it be better if I stood up? Are you fine with me sitting? Good. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for being here. When Kathy Dunneman and I, my publicist at the publisher Farrar, Straus, Giroux, thought about where we would like to do an event in New York when the book was launched, for me there was only one place, because this has come to be my home in New York in many ways. I had a fellowship from the OSI, as Steve mentioned, for 18 months. And to be perfectly honest, if it wasn't for the OSI, there'd probably still be about a decade's wait for the book. In addition to which, I would like to point out that in parallel with the book, I've been working on a website which went up last Friday at the official launch of the book in the United Kingdom, which is just called theshadowworld.com. At the moment, in a fairly basic form, it has certain documents that we couldn't quite find space for, an appendix in the book. And so the documents that some of the most contentious cases in the book are based on are available on the website. There is also, in very formative stage, an arms trade manual. And that will be growing over the next 6 months to a point where I hope it is a very useful and practical tool for people working on the arms trade around the world, be they legislators in the sort of position that I was in, be they grassroots activists who are trying to find out more about deals that are being done in their name by their governments, but about which there is very little public information, be they investigative journalists or a variety of others. And it'll be both a networking tool, but also with practical examples, case studies, information about companies, about certain types of weapons transactions. And the existence of that website, the credit again goes to OSI, as I worked on it while I was a fellow, although all responsibility for the contents are mine alone. So I would really just like to take this opportunity to thank the fellowship team here, Lenny, Steve, Bipasha, Lissy, and Alia, who have just been the most extraordinary support for me over the last couple of years, not just in terms of providing a living, which when one has two young children is no bad thing, but also in terms of the network that they've given me access to through the Open Society family and way beyond it. And then others at the Open Society, Ken Hurwitz, Sandy Colliver, Anthony Richter, Tom Kellogg, and many, many more. Also, obviously, thanks to my publishers, FSG, and I would very quickly, before this starts sounding like an Oscar speech, like to also just thank a couple of people in the audience, especially Bill Harting, who has been working on US weapons procurement and the defense contractors for a very, very long time and has been something of an inspiration to me and has... He's 22. But really has been incredibly supportive with information, answering endless queries that I've been sending him, and just generally with personal support. So thank you very much, Bill, for that as well. Finally, just very quickly to Kathy and to Jeff, thank you so much for sharing the platform and for being here. And I feel very proud to be on this platform with you. I better repeat that with the microphone on. Steve just reminded you that copies of the book are for sale outside, and I'm very happy to sign them. It feels as though that's all I've been doing for the last week. And the first event, which was a public lecture I gave at the London School of Economics, which is available on that website, theshadowworld.com, if you want to listen to the lecture on a podcast, was on the 1st of the 11th, 11. So I had great fun just doing five ones on everybody's book. And of course, there were people who said, so what is the significance of the five ones? And I had to point out to them that it was the date. I'm going to really give a highlight certain issues in a very, well, I'll try and be very concise, that will then hopefully lead to a discussion. Kathy will talk briefly about the Victor Boot trial that has recently concluded. And Jeff will talk about the International Arms Trade Treaty, both of which I'm going to make comment on. The book that, according to Amazon, is, I don't know, 720 or 760 pages long, is actually 600 and something pages long, but it is a long book. And that includes about 3,000 footnotes. So the narrative is actually quite a bit shorter than that, thanks to my editors, I have to say. And I suppose the starting point is that global military expenditure for 2010 is estimated to have totaled $1.6 trillion, $235 for every person on the planet. The United States spends almost $1 trillion itself every year on national security, with a defense budget of just over $700 billion. Interestingly, the trade in conventional arms, both big and small, actually only amounts to an average of $60 billion a year, which, given those other figures, might not sound that big. But this expenditure has profound impacts on the world we live in, from the enabling, fueling, and perpetuation of conflict to the corrosion of democracy in both buying and selling countries, and the massive opportunity costs in terms of socioeconomic development in emerging countries and the prosperity and well-being of ordinary citizens in more advanced economies. The one thing that became very clear to me as I started researching this, and I'll explain a bit to you about how I got to this topic, as Steve mentioned, is that arms deals stretch across a continuum of legality, from the official or formal trade to the gray and black markets. And I refer to the gray and black markets as the shadow world, as they involve elements of illegality, or in the case of black markets, both the conception and execution of the deals tend to be entirely illegal. In a remarkable piece of work that was conducted by a guy called Joe Rober, who at that time was at Transparency International in the United Kingdom, accessing figures from a number of treasuries around the world, as well as a number of intelligence agencies, he calculated that despite its size, the global trade in arms accounted, and the last year for which he has complete figures is 2003, for almost 40% of all corruption in all global trade. A truly astounding figure. Simply put, in the formal trade in weapons, sometimes known as the government-to-government trade, you have a very small number of people, in the case of a South African deal, six people, making decisions about contracts often worth tens of billions of dollars, and doing that behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy. Now, those are perfect conditions for corruption, hence the 40%. Both the corruption itself, but as much the efforts to conceal the corruption, undermine the rule of law in buying and selling countries, distort the market, and pollute the business environment, the political process, and the functioning of the state. And as Steve mentioned, I experienced this firsthand as an ANC Member of Parliament in South Africa, where in late 1998 and 1999, despite having committed this being the ANC, the party of which I was part, and in fact I'm still a member of, to reducing defense spending in favor of socioeconomic spending as democracy came to South Africa in 1994, the then Deputy President, Thabo Mbeki, led a process to spend what will amount by the end of the contracts to almost $10 billion on weapons that the country neither needs and in large measure uses. $300 million in bribes were paid on those contracts to the defense minister at the time, his political advisor, the head of procurement in the South African National Defense Force, the current president, Jacob Zuma, and to the African National Congress itself. So when I was re-elected to Parliament in 1999, little did I know that the money that funded that election campaign were from the proceeds of the bribes paid by the winning contractors on the arms deal. It's also worth noting that this was at a time that our then president, he became president in 1999, Thabo Mbeki, claimed that the country could not afford to provide antiretroviral medication to the over 5 million South Africans then living with HIV and AIDS. The School of Public Health at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard have calculated that over the first 5.5 years of the arms deal, conservatively, 355,000 South Africans died avoidable deaths because their government was more willing to spend money on weapons than on life-saving medication. in some but different ways as tragic is the fact that to cover up this corruption, the leadership of the ANC, many of whom had fought so courageously to bring about the democracy that South Africa acquired in 1994, was prepared to undermine those very institutions of democracy to hide their own corruption. I was the ranking ANC member on the main Financial Oversight Committee in Parliament at the time, and was told by the President in no uncertain terms to stop any investigation into the arms deal. When I refused, I was removed from the committee and replaced by party whips. A committee that had always reached decision by consensus became a voting committee along party political lines, and the ANC majority voted down any further participation by Parliament in any investigation into the deal. Over 10 years later, last weekend, that committee was still being criticized as having become nothing more than a rubber stamp to the executive, the perception of Parliament as a whole. The prosecuting authorities in the country were completely undermined. They were supposed to be constitutionally independent bodies. They were told by the President exactly who and what they could and could not investigate. And there was a very simple methodology. If you were involved in corruption and a political ally of the President, you weren't investigated. If you were involved in corruption but were a political enemy of the President's or a political threat to the President within the party, you were investigated, as was the case with Mr. Zuma. The country's two main anti-corruption bodies were closed down because of their zeal to get to the bottom of the corruption in the deal. Just 2 weeks ago, Kgalema Motlanthe, the country's deputy president, lamented again that both the ANC and the country's government at all levels is drowning in corruption. This is not something that's unique to South Africa, that's unique to the continent of Africa, despite sometimes caricaturish representations of the continent as one monolithic, homogeneous body. I think that the nature of corruption in the arms trade globally is simply of different orders of sophistication in different places. In the United States, which certainly for the decades of the 60s, the 70s, and the early 80s was seen as the main corruptor in terms of foreign export deals in arms, has, since the toughening up of the FCPA and its stricter enforcement, been engaged in far less corruption internationally than it was during those decades. However, domestically, and I say this as an outsider who was involved in building a public finance management infrastructure in a new democracy, it appears to me that the system of weapons procurement in this country is built on a circle of patronage between defense companies, lobbyists, lawmakers, the White House, and the Pentagon. A scheme of mutual backscratching that is not breaking US law, but would be seen as illegal bribery in many other countries in the world. A Capitol Hill aide, who I spoke to very early in my research, described the US system to me as a form of legal bribery. Its consequences are often inordinately expensive weapon systems that are sometimes inappropriate to the country's defense needs, very seldom perform as promised, and are often delivered years, sometimes decades late. How else but in these systemic terms could one explain the folly that is the F-35 jet fighter? The most expensive of its type ever built, the current estimate of its cost of over $380 billion is expected to increase by 25% to 30%. It's a jet that would have been useful during the Cold War, but is largely irrelevant to the conflicts in which the the United States finds itself engaged today. One former Pentagon aerospace engineer who was involved in a number of the F-35's forebearers, and in fact in the early days of this jet itself, described it to me, and I ask you to excuse my language, as a total piece of crap. Far worse than the various planes it is replacing, and more likely to endanger its test pilots than anyone else. And as for checks and balances of these sorts of things, well, the Pentagon, the biggest employer and the biggest spender in the US government, hasn't been audited for over two decades. The Pentagon informed Congress a few months ago that it might be audit ready by 2017. The other dimension of the arms trade is that the actions of governments also support the black and gray trades in weapons. On the South African deal, the main covert agent employed by BAE Systems, the large British company and one of the three largest defense manufacturers in the world, used a covert agent by the name of John Breedenkamp. His other activities at the time, providing weapons to Robert Mugabe and the trafficking of weapons into the Democratic Republic of Congo and natural resources out of the DRC in return. And Victor Boot, who is finally behind bars, in part thanks to the work of Kathy and others who've been tracking his work for years. But interestingly, while there was an Interpol warrant for his arrest, he was ferrying equipment and ammunition into Iraq for, amongst others, the US Department of Defense and KBR. Or Joe Dehovsepian, a Lebanese-Armenian arms dealer who has been in the trade for over four decades, starting with an organization called Merex, formed in the 1950s in post-war Germany by a group of former senior Nazi officers, who I had seen reference to in a footnote of a commission report and tracked for months and months and months without success until my 14-year-old niece suggested to me that I should look for him on Facebook. To be completely honest with you, I didn't really know what Facebook was. So she set up a page for me, and we put his name in, and sure enough, there was a 70-year-old gentleman wearing a Stetson in his Facebook photograph. I sent him an email. I got one line in response. In my long life, I've never done anything for nothing. Why should I start now? I didn't really have an answer, and I had nothing to offer him except flattery. So over a period of months, I sent him emails telling him that every person I was meeting said that he knew more about the global arms trade than anyone else alive. And eventually, sitting in my North London office, I got a call on my cell phone one Thursday afternoon. And a very Germanic voice said, "This is Dehovsepian. I'll be in my office in Amman, Jordan on Sunday. Come and have a chat." And really, without thinking about it, I got on a plane and off I went. And when I arrived in Jordan, I'd had 5.5 hours to think about what I was doing. And my wife had said to me as I was leaving, "You sure this is safe?" And I said, "Oh, of course it is." By the time I got to my hotel, I went up to the concierge and I said, "I have a meeting with someone that I'm not 100% sure about. Is it okay if I take your cell number and I text you every half hour? And if you don't hear from me for more than an hour, please phone me on my cell number. And if I don't answer, please send someone to this address." Well, I have to confess that Dehovsepian was an absolutely charming host who told me in great detail for 6.5 hours about his exploits in this industry over 40 years. In which he had proudly broken perhaps more UN arms embargoes than anybody else and still managed to stay under the radar. This was the first time he had ever been interviewed. After telling me all of these stories, he very proudly produced his contractor ID for his work for the U.S. Department of Defense in Iraq and Afghanistan, and for KBR in the same conflict, and his contractor ID for his work with USAID in Liberia. I describe in the book the inevitable blowback, the unintended consequences of the arms trade, perhaps the most notorious example of which is the efforts that the former Congressman Charlie Wilson made to arm the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and the story that his biographer tells of after 9/11, Wilson drinking himself into a stupor before finally, after about a week or 10 days, staggering onto his balcony, looking over the Potomac and seeing the Pentagon and saying, "I can't believe this all happened from my mountains." And currently, the cases of the Arab Spring, of Egypt and Libya, where the US armed Hosni Mubarak to the tune of over $21 billion from 1981, when he came to power, until late 2010, and played a part, along with the Europeans and the Russians, who really did more of the arming of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya. And the irony of the NATO airstrikes, where one of the first things they had to do was destroy the weaponry that was being used against the rebels in Libya that NATO member states had sold to the Gaddafi regime. And now we have the situation where a lot of the weaponry that was sold to Gaddafi has already appeared on the black market, including surface-to-air missiles. There are all sorts of other consequences that I don't have time to go into. The one that struck me on the plane over here in terms of the fiscal consequences is whether in these economically straitened times we can justify or afford to continue spending $1.6 trillion a year on all of this, especially if one looks at the number of other manufacturing jobs that could be created for the same investment into a single job in the defense sector. And the numbers range between 3 and 7 jobs in other manufacturing sectors to every one in the defense sector. Or the extraordinary situation of Greece, which is on the brink of catastrophe, where I read over the last few days that particularly Germany and France and the United States are pushing the Greek government, as we know, to cut back on everything: health, education, pensions, except defense spending. There has been no cut in defense spending in Greece during the current fiscal crisis. Why? Because the United States of America provides 42% of Greece's weapons, and it buys a proportionally excess amount of weapons because of tensions with Turkey. Greece is Germany's biggest single customer in Europe, and France is their third biggest supplier with 12.5% of their market. So what is to be done? We're in the throes of negotiations for an international arms trade treaty. I would argue that the crucial issues that need to be addressed in that treaty include far greater transparency. Of course, there needs to be confidentiality of certain aspects of national security and commercial confidentiality, for that matter. But this veil of national security secrecy is also being used to hide what is effectively criminal behavior in the formal and the shadow trades. A publish what you pay, if you will, in regard to the middlemen and agents who are so often the conduits of the bribes. Vigorous anti-corruption measures, which are actively enforced, requiring more internationalized law enforcement, and certainly no weakening of the FCPA, which is being touted by, amongst others, the US Chamber of Business. Far harsher penalties for individuals and companies involved in transgressing laws in relation to the trade, including possible debarment from public contracts and prosecution of individual executives, all of which need the most difficult thing of all, which is political will. But I would argue in conclusion that we, the bankrollers of this trade, should know more, far more about the shadow world that affects us all, and have far more say in the way in which it operates and in whose interests. Otherwise, the trade in weapons will continue to make the world a poorer place, a less democratic place, a more corrupt place, and a more dangerous place. With that, I'm going to start, if I can, and I wonder whether we should perhaps talk about the ATT first and then the Boot trial, given that I ended with the ATT, but perhaps ask Jeff, who has been so involved in this coalition of organizations working on the ATT, coalition of NGOs, to tell us a little about the ATT and his hopes for it.
Thank you, Andrew, and it's an honor for me to be on this stage with, not many know the story, but Kathy Austin is actually a person who got me involved in this work many years ago when I was a graduate student. And Andrew, I only met, I think, last year, actually, and I was immediately amazed by not just his storytelling ability, but his passion and his story, showing the real human side behind the challenge. I think what this book does for me is lay out what the real, how difficult the challenge is to make even modest progress on regulating the arms trade. And I'm still making my way through, it's still 500 something pages of text before the end of it. But the last page is on the arms trade treaty. But what's really in this book is a reminder that this is difficult, that it's pervasive, and that there will be modest progress, but we'll have to keep fighting along the way. So the arms trade treaty itself is an effort, a global effort to create regulations on the arms trade. Right now, this is an unregulated community. Part of that is for national security purposes. Countries don't necessarily want to be accountable to others. The arms trade treaty has gone actually very quickly from an idea of a very few people to something that now almost all states are engaged in negotiations on. Next summer, here in New York, in July, there's a four-week negotiating conference where countries will decide whether and what the arms trade treaty will be. I think it's a what. The weather is, I'm pretty optimistic that there will be one. And let me just give you a brief sense of the Control Arms Coalition itself is a coalition of non-governmental organizations around the globe who are interested in the arms trade treaty primarily for its human side. And I think that's where Andrew starts in his story in South Africa when you talk about they could have spent money on arms, you could have spent money on saving lives. And we know that those decisions and the way the arms trade now goes, not just those decisions that governments consciously make, but also the illegal trade or the black market or shadow world creates distortions, makes it hard for people to continue to live in cases or to have a livelihood. So that's what drives the international coalition. The treaty itself is going to revolve the conversation around three areas, and I think the last of these areas is the one where I think Andrew's work is most powerful in terms of reminding us the work that needs to be done. One of the areas in the Arms Trade Treaty is what scope it will have, so what types of weapons will be regulated, as well as what types of transactions. So as your book really details, it's not just my government and your government make a deal. There's a lot of other people involved in this that aren't paid attention to. The United States has laws on defining and regulating brokers, but a lot of countries don't. This is one thing Kathy can talk about with the Victor Boot case. Another, which is I think critical, is the criteria that will be used for deciding what is a legitimate trade. The Arms Trade Treaty is about defining legitimate trade, and once we can define it, maybe we can also start tackling limiting and controlling the illegitimate trade. But states seem to be generally willing to say arms transfers shouldn't happen to break UN embargoes, even though the history of breaking UN embargoes is pretty awful. But some of the things that we're fighting for, and I think Andrew agrees with, are that if there's clear risk of violation of international humanitarian law, of human rights, of socioeconomic development, that those are also cases where arms shouldn't be transferred, or if they are transferred, there's a lot of things that go on to make sure that they're not used for those violations. And then the third part of this is the implementation, how countries will actually go about this. And right now it looks like states themselves are going to be implementing the treaty, so they're going to have to up their own laws. I think a lot of your suggestions aren't going to be in the treaty, but with active lobbying, maybe we can get some countries to take on a lot of those ideas of potential disbarment or stopping of traders if they're, you know, consistently found to be problematic, much stiffer penalties. I'm hopeful that some countries will take these ideas from the book and put those in place. But the transparency side of this, which I think is also crucial, and as I look at this treaty, this is the role civil society is going to have, is to making sure countries are living up to what they agree to, because I'm not sure states themselves will hold each other accountable. We've got to have the transparency in this treaty that will make that possible. As Andrew points out, in the global arms trade, we're talking about a $60 billion figure, which is an estimate. In some countries, we have a much better sense of what the real number is, and some we don't. And we're hoping that with a little bit more public transparency, we can start down the task of getting a handle on this, which will be a step and a large work still to be done.
Thanks very much,
Jeff. Thank you.
Let's take the individual case. And I was wondering last week, as the verdict was given in the trial, how many people were focused on the Victor Boot trial and how many were waiting for the verdict in the Michael Jackson trial. And I think the answer is clear, but we shouldn't underestimate the importance of the conviction in the Victor Boot trial, especially because, as Kathy knows more than most, victories in this sort of area are extremely rare. So with appropriate congratulations, Kathy, if you'd just like to tell us a bit about the trial and your thoughts on it.
Well, thank you very much for all being here tonight, for Andrew, for just putting together an incredible book, which really illuminates some of the tricky issues around what is the legal trade, the gray market, and the black market. I've been focusing for a long time on the black market trade, so I just have a small niche, and Andrew has really tried to conquer the whole picture, which I think is incredibly daunting. I also just want to thank my colleague Jeff for being here tonight. Jeff was a student at Berkeley, and I was responsible for assigning a case study to a group of students to look at arms trafficking into Colombia, which is actually a case that took place in 1999, where Victor Boot actually trafficked weapons to the FARC rebels at the time. So unfortunately, we weren't able to get that clear message out that this was a problem that needed tackling at the time, but at least we fast-forwarded many years later. And as Andrew's mentioned, we got a verdict, I think, which really resonates very strongly for justice. I want to thank my colleagues in the room who are here to support me tonight. We have other members of the Conflict Awareness Project. We have Oxfam, which provided a grant which sustained me throughout the duration of the Victor Boot trial. And we also have OSF, which has provided funding for other trafficking investigations, which are currently underway, which we can't talk about, but which I hope will have a good ending at some point as well. I think it's important to look at Victor Boot just because of what he epitomizes. We're talking about a man who began right at the end of the Cold War, who went out and basically became the poster boy, the emblematic person for how to traffic weapons, how to corrupt everyone in his path, in order to get weapons into the hands of whatever client was needy, only to make a profit. There wasn't anything ideologically interesting to Victor Boot. He didn't have his sort of heart and passion in any of the war zones which he affected. He basically did it for a single purpose, and that was profit. And that profit motive is what drove a lot of the illegal arms trafficking throughout the 1990s. We had the end of the Cold War, government sort of concerned governments, the United States, Russia, turned their back on a lot of the proxy wars that they had initiated. When things began to fall apart, they left the infrastructure behind for these arms traffickers to step into the niche. They still had the supplies that they wanted to get rid of. These traffickers had been operatives for governments before, so they had the know-how. They knew the tried-and-true methods. And the main failure of the world is that there were no laws on the book. Nationally, there was no international global regime to control their transnational and cross-border operations. There was a lack of political will, as Andrew has discussed, to enforce UN embargoes, because that's where most of this activity was occurring, in areas that were under UN sanctions regimes. So we had these operators were able to build incredible empires throughout the 1990s. At least we're sort of two decades later, we finally have a victory. And I think I'm probably on the panel tonight a little bit, so that not all seems like doom and gloom. It's a remarkable victory to see Victor Boot behind bars, and I don't want to go into the trial dynamics a lot, because if you have questions, I'd prefer to address those during the question and answer period to sort of speak to what you may want to ask. But what's important to know is that throughout this two-decade period, which Victor Boot reigned as one of the biggest arms traffickers, he basically corrupted everyone in his path. This is really, truly, as Andrew has pointed out, a story of corruption. And if you listen to the trial transcripts, there are recordings of Victor Boot's wiretapped conversations to his co-conspirators in the particular case for which he was tried. You begin to get a sense of what his formula for war was, his recipe for bringing in illegal weapons, for supplying almost an entire arsenal to the in this case it was the FARC, but it was a formula that was tried and true for him, for whatever warlord, criminal network, militia group, tyrannical government that wanted to be under the radar and receive Victor Boot's wares. In the trial, Victor Boot says, okay, the FARC rebels, you want weapons? Here's what you have to do. First of all, you're going to pay me. I'm under an UN arms embargo assets freeze, so we can't use American dollars, because I've already had $6 billion worth frozen in American, European, and Swiss banks. So in order to launder the money that you're going to pay me for, we have to go and buy a bank. And he recommended buying a bank in either Russia, Belarus, or Venezuela. That was step number one. Step number two, where are we going to find the weapon supplies? Okay, well, the former Warsaw Pact suppliers have ubiquitous stockpiles that they're anxious to get rid of. Bulgaria, I happen to know a couple of friends. How do I know these friends that own arms factories? Because I meet regularly with them at defense exhibitions around the world. The last time I saw the person that's going to supply this particular arsenal, I met him in United Arab Emirates at the Defects exhibition. No problem. But there is this problem of getting an end user certificate. We got to have some kind of documentation that's going to make it easy for us to transport these weapons. Now, end user certificates, they're supposed to be authenticated. So how are we going to go about doing this? Well, I know that Egypt has had contracts with the Bulgarian manufacturer, but they haven't completely fulfilled their contract yet. So they've got this little wiggle room. So we'll go to Egypt and we'll get fake end user certificates for the weapons that we want to traffic into Colombia. Okay, that's all settled. What next? How do we get the weapons into the jungle in South America, into the FARC hands? Okay, so we need to have a base of operations for our aviation companies. Let's set up in a nearby country. arms traffickers always need a transshipment point. In this case, Victor Boot had decided on Nicaragua. They are Nicaragua, we can corrupt them, we'll establish our base of operations there. We'll pretend that we're flying to Brazil, which they would fly to Brazil, and when we land at Brazil, in Brazil, after we airdrop the weapons, we'll load on flour and some fruits so we can make it look like our transport this entire way was some kind of legal commodity. Meanwhile, I'll outfit your plane with parachutes so that these weapons can be dropped into the hands of the FARC. And Victor Boot mentioned doing the same operation, in his own words, 5,000 times in the past. That's the recipe for war, the formula for war that Victor Boot managed to emulate over and over again for nearly 20 years until finally he was reined in. But I think what Andrew's book points out is that even though we have Victor Boot now behind bars for this attempted deal, there's still all the other elements that need sealing up. The Bulgarian manufacturer, the Egyptian corrupt officials that were going to supply the false documentation, the false end user certificate, the corrupt officials in Nicaragua that were going to allow this fake transshipment air operation to be based. In Brazil, all the bribes, the corrupt officials, where immediately upon landing, they were going to fill the plane with other disguised goods. All of those particular areas are the kinds of concerns we have that Andrew addresses very well in his book, and I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Kathy. So we've had one very particular case, and bear in mind, not only are there other elements that need to be addressed, but there are also many other Victor Boots out there, some of which, or some of whom I reveal in the book, the vast majority of whom didn't want to speak to me. And I'm sure there are a whole lot more I never even heard of, so I couldn't even try and get them to speak to me. We've also heard about an ongoing process to try and address certain aspects of the trade. And I think at this point, we're going to ask you whether you have either any comments, any questions for any of us about any aspect of the trade that is of interest to you. And what we're going to do, I would ask you, if you wouldn't mind, when you ask your question, if you could just tell us who you are. At my events in London, I have to say there were a number of people who would only give a pseudonym. So I had quite a few,
oh,
I had quite a few questions from John Smith and from Peter Jones over the past week. But also, obviously, feel free to do that if that would make you more comfortable. Do you have the microphone? Oh, it's on its way to you. The gentleman over there and then the gentleman in the front here.
Yes, hi. My name is Akwasi Edu. I live in Senegal. I think in Africa, you know, the really big elephant in the room is, for the future at least, is probably China. And so I'm really curious about what you have to say about China's role. I mean, we know a couple of years ago, China was in the process of arming Robert Mugabe soon after the elections. And I think it was the dock workers of, was it Cape Town? That
of Durban, yeah.
Durban, that literally stopped it. You have North Korea. In the early 80s, you know, the Matabeleland massacres, which were committed in Matabeleland, where over 10,000 people were killed, the role of North Korea and North Korean arms. So, I mean, there are all these countries that probably don't rise to, you know, to the levels that you've mentioned. But I think looking into the future, I mean, what would you say is going to be the trend.
Yep.
From countries like China.
Should we take a couple of questions together, or should we deal with that one first? Yeah, let's go on China initially. And please, if anybody in the audience would like to respond to or comment on any of the questions, also please just indicate, and we'd be very happy for you to do that. China and the arms trade, I think, would be another, probably even larger book on its own. It's so fascinating, both in terms of what it says about Chinese society, economics, and politics, and what it says about the global arms trade. I think that very succinctly, if I look on the continent that is of great concern to me, which is obviously Africa, China has been playing a quite insidious role in terms of the trade in weapons. You mentioned that he has been supplying Robert Mugabe, and as far as I know, continues to do so. But the approach to the arms trade from the Chinese vacillates. I think it would be inappropriate to say that there is one position that the Chinese have. I mean, I've seen examples of all sorts of distinct behavior, and one of the other fellows at the OSI, Howard French, the New York Times writer, is engaged in extraordinary work at the moment on the general role of Chinese in Africa and how they are being perceived. And what we found is that both the big Chinese parastatal arms companies, if I can call them that, have been playing a very important role in getting weapons into Africa. They're supplying them a lot cheaper than a lot of their competitors, but more importantly, I think they're supplying them at the stage with the claim that there are no strings attached. It's a little like the notion of a free lunch. There ain't no such thing. So I think the role of China in the arms trade going forward is going to be a very interesting one to watch. But the other thing that I think interests me greatly is, besides that sort of more formal level of Chinese engagement where it is doing some government-to-government deals, there is no doubt that there is significant Chinese involvement in getting weaponry into conflict zones, because we are seeing a lot of weapons of Chinese origin turning up in those zones. And it's not just Africa. The other case that interested me was Sri Lanka, where just before the assault on the Tamil sections of Sri Lankan society, there was an inflow formally of Chinese weapons to the Sri Lankan government. So I think this is a huge issue, not just for Africa, but globally. And I think a lot more work needs to be done on it. I'd be very intrigued to hear what Jeff's views are with regard to China and the ATT. And then obviously, Kathy, if you have anything to add on China's role.
No, it's very interesting. I was in Beijing earlier this year, actually, and it's, I want to say reading tea leaves is just too easy a pun to go here. But clearly, China is going to be getting China into the arms trade treaty is going to be very important. And I think the United States clearly recognizes that. And I think because of its role in Africa, and it's the place that it currently plays, it's an essential player, even though its market share is small in the global arms trade. It's very intriguing. One of the things that we've found, actually, is China is very hard to talk with at times. They, at this point, don't want to see small arms and light weapons included in the treaty, which for many of us is the critical thing that needs to be included in the treaty, as well as ammunition. China's not there yet, and partly that's because there is already a voluntary register of conventional weaponry that exists. It's called the UN Register of Conventional Arms, that has seven voluntary categories and then an eighth category of a voluntary category, which is small arms and light weapons, which aren't seen as strongly as those seven categories of offensive weapons like battleships and fighter aircraft, which are a little bit harder to hide than small arms and light weapons. We're hoping to see progress. One of the things that has happened, actually, is frequently African states that are clients, but in many places in Africa, there's actually a recognition that the trade in weaponry is damaging. So there are a number of regional organizations that have formed to try and combat the arms trade, and we actually see African states telling the Chinese, no, you need to get better. I think longer term, what's going to be interesting to watch is, as China continues to develop on the global stage, does it move from a country that claims non-interference in any country's domestic goings to a more responsible player. And I think at times I see inklings of it. Mm-hmm. And whether that's going to be a pattern that persists or happens and develops, I'm optimistic about. But I don't, you know, I'm just one person making a guess. But I'm optimistic, but China is one of those players that's going to be tough.
Yeah, I'll just add one intriguing note, and perhaps a little bit of a silver lining if we work hard. China feels very vulnerable to international pressure and the way it's perceived. And one example is that China has been engaged over the years in supplying weapons into the Congo and actually to different sides in the Congo. But what China was doing at the time was it was disguising its arms supplies with North Korean markings. By the way, North Korea was trying to disguise its weapons supplies into the same area using Chinese markings. But it does show that if they're going to this particular length to try to disguise its weapon flows, that it does feel in some sense vulnerable to international attention, opprobrium. So that is a place where perhaps we can continue to work with China in trying to.
Thank you. I mean, the one point I'll add before going to the next questioner is that this phenomenon of supplying both or all sides in a conflict is something that is all too common in the trade, not only in the case of individual black market dealers like Victor Boot and his like, but also by governments. There are a number of governments who have supplied multiple protagonists in a variety of conflicts.
Thank you. My name's William Grassi, Metanexus Institute. Just as an aside, I spent a year in Sri Lanka at the end of the Civil War, so it's very, very interesting to see the Chinese involvement there and how they're playing off Iran, Pakistan, and China. But actually, I have a question about the United States. And how much does the National Rifle Association provide political coverage? I mean, you know, if Americans have a right to bear arms, shouldn't everyone have a right to bear arms? And I'm just curious whether, I mean, what's the connection domestically? I mean, you're obviously, Andrew, you're not the right person to answer this, but perhaps my fellow citizens would care to comment.
Please do.
Well, do you want to take a stab first, Jeff?
Yeah, I'll go first. Okay. It's very intriguing right now. The NRA is currently running robocalls to people telling, you know, sort of this, I haven't gotten one, but told me. I don't even think you have to be a member to get the call, but you know, it sort of asks a number of leading questions, and then something along the lines is, you know, do you want the UN to take away your guns? And you know, I shared the stage with the head of the NRA at during the PrepCom in July. He and I don't agree. But the NRA it's just devoid of facts. That's what's really difficult, specifically from the arms trade treaty angle. This treaty that's being negotiated is going to have nothing really to do with domestic ownership regulation. You know, domestic ownership is not part of the treaty, and it was actually part of America's urging to be part of this process that is actually written into the sort of the preambular language of the text that sets up the negotiation process. So there is no attempt by the UN to take away American guns. And I'd be happy to have that message repeated many times. but I find it very hard when I travel and to explain to people outside the United States sort of the gun culture in this country, it's almost unfathomable outside of the United States. Yeah. And it's very interesting. You know, there's a interesting histories about this, and ideas behind gun control have come and gone, and the NRA has at times been a proponent of it in its history. But there is this segment of society that sort of feels that they have to own a gun in order to feel protected from government, and it runs deep. But it's also somewhat based on misunderstanding I think there is a strong contingency within gun owners of responsible ownership, and you can talk to people about the responsibility of the global arms trade and whether you think it's responsible for countries to be able to arm warlords for the illegal trade. And I think that that message resonates. But the other thing that resonates within a number of NRA members as well as across the United States is the moral argument behind the arms trade treaty, behind regulating the flow of weaponry. So right now, you know, the NRA has gotten over 50 senators to sign on to a letter saying don't support an arms trade treaty if it takes away our right to bear arms. And I'm hoping that when the treaty is negotiated and it has no impact on the right to bear arms, that the other parts of those letters, which talk about how we should fight the illicit trade, we should keep warlords from getting weapons, I can go to them and say, okay, I agree with all this, and your concern has been taken care of. Can we move forward? You can decide whether that seems possible or not, but that's it's an intriguing time right now. And if we can get to a fact-based question, we'd be much better off.
Well, this is where I come back to a sad story. And that was exactly 10 years ago. There was a conference at the United Nations to address the problem of the illicit arms trade. 2001, July. Prior to that, the U.S. was going in with a very strong negotiating position where there was hope that a legally binding global regime to regulate arms traffickers would come about. It was the Clinton administration which had worked very hard on arriving at that position. We had the election in 2000. We had John Bolton, who was a very strong advocate of coming out of the pro-gun lobby, which went into that 2001 conference and basically undermined a lot of the work that had been done for a decade to come out of that particular conference with a very strong treaty. We have a little bit of a problem next year in that it's an election year. And there is a concern that because of domestic political sensitivities, the U.S. negotiating position could be weakened. We need a really tough, strong U.S. negotiating position going into the arms trade treaty if we have any hope that it will be robust, that it will be comprehensive, and that it will have the teeth to really tackle the problem of weapons getting into the wrong hands.
Thanks. I confess, I don't get it. As a non-American citizen, it's something I write in the book about how I came here to meet a journalist who's written a lot from what I would describe as a progressive political position on the arms trade. And in the UK, where I now live, in South Africa, you go hunting if you're a part of the Afrikaans-speaking establishment. It's not quite as religiously fervent as the sport of rugby, but very few people do it, and you hunt big game. In the United Kingdom, I didn't go to any of the right schools, so I'm never invited hunting, and I'm not of a social class that engages at the activity. So I came here to meet a journalist who has very similar views to me on the arms trade. And we had a great meeting. We went for a meal. And then he asked me what I was doing over the weekend, and I said I wasn't sure yet. And he said, well, why don't you come? We can shoot my new gun. And I just didn't get it. It's something I just have not been able to get my head around. So I'm not going to make any further comment. There was another hand. The lady at the back.
My
thanks, Steve.
Elizabeth. It was very interesting for you to make that comment about NATO using arms. Oh, thank you. NATO using arms to bomb Libya, the same weapons that had been sold to Libya by the NATO allies. And one of the things, my remarks were to people during this whole period was, now this is really very interesting. Gaddafi was not Saddam Hussein, and the ANC would not exist if Gaddafi hadn't been funneling weapons to them so that they could be liberated. So the question is that, I know that there's this Cold War and end of Cold War perspective, but at what point are shadow suppliers good, or are they not good, or the aspect of regulating suppliers who are about helping freedom fighters, in fact, gain their freedom?
Okay. Thank you very much for the question. Just in terms of Libya, I think the point that needs to be made is that, as some of you might know, Gaddafi funded the ANC for many years. And very soon after being released from jail, Nelson Mandela went to visit Gaddafi. And Mandela, who I feel extraordinarily privileged to have served during my 7.5 years in government in South Africa and to have worked with, if he has one weakness, and this is going to sound weird, because in a friend this is exactly what you want. In a political leader it might not be exactly what you want. He has a degree of personal loyalty that is astounding. He will never speak badly of or cut off anybody who has helped him or the ANC, which saw him accepting assistance from some extremely dubious people inside South Africa as well as outside. In the case of Gaddafi, he could see no wrong. I wouldn't go so far as to say the ANC wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Gaddafi. He wasn't their main source of financing or of weaponry. That role was played, interestingly, by the Swedes and by the Soviet Union for many years. But he was an important funder and an important player. And it's why Jacob Zuma flip-flopped around the no-fly resolution. He changed his position 3 times on it because it was something that was quite difficult for him internally within the ANC. But the broader question of, is there a point at which shadow dealers are good? Were they, for instance, helping freedom fighters? I'm going to respond to that with two very quick stories that are illustrative. The first is of an American who was a trade unionist here. And he acted as the link between his very large American trade union, and this was quite a few decades ago. This was in the 60s, when trade unions, I think, were a lot more powerful than perhaps they are today globally, not just in the US. He acted as the link between this American trade union and the liberation leaders in various parts of Africa. And he knew an extraordinary array of the continent's liberation leaders incredibly well. And when they came into power, he saw an opportunity, and he went into transport and logistics, which is what a lot of arms dealers, how they describe their activities. He, for a time, shared an office with Victor Boot when Victor was based in South Africa. He is still very active in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And if you ask him why he does what he does, he says he is a force for liberation and good. The irony is that he went to Robert Mugabe's 85th birthday party a few years ago in Harare because he was one of his clients. And when he got back from the party, I said to him, "So how was it?" And he said, "Oh, it was terrible." So I said, "Oh, this is interesting. Why?" He said, "Well, I walked in, and who's the first guy I see but John Bredenkamp, who is the chap I mentioned earlier from whom I receive lots of threatening letters." And he said to me, "I don't want to be at a party with scum like that." And he's engaged in exactly the same activity. I think that the vast, vast majority of shadow world operators or dealers that I've come across tend not so much, while they might initially be driven by a certain degree of ideology, I think that certainly takes second place to the profitability of what they are doing, which is why so many of them land up supporting diametrically opposite forces in various conflicts. Joe de Hovsepian, the gentleman I met in Jordan, he had been described by a South African operative in the State Arms Company during the apartheid years, because you won't be surprised to hear that Joe de Hovsepian broke the arms embargo against apartheid South Africa. And this guy in South Africa described de Hovsepian as the scariest human being he'd ever met. So at the end of our interview, when I thought that Joe and I were getting on quite well, I said to him, so why did Mr. Kleinhans describe you as the scariest man he'd ever met? De Hovsepian stood up behind his large desk, and I'm not particularly tall at the best of times, but I was sitting down and writing at his desk. And I looked at him, and he still had his Stetson on. He never takes it off. He even drove me back to my hotel with his Stetson on. And he stood up, and he had this big grin on his face, and he said, it's probably because I put a gun to his head and told him I was going to kill him. And I'm sort of sitting there taking notes, and I said, yeah, that could have done it. And he said in all seriousness, no, first he wasn't serious. He said, laughed uproariously, and he said, what I didn't tell him is that I only buy and sell this stuff. I don't use it. I'm a pacifist. About 4 hours earlier, he had told me about the first time he shot somebody. And that's the joy of interviewing these people, is they contradict themselves so much that you almost don't need anything else but a conversation with them. But the incredible thing is, I think the reason that he spoke to me is because he believes he has a great legacy, that he has done great good in the world, and he now has decided that he wants to be known for this. So he concluded our interview by saying, everything I have done has been in defense of humanity. I have armed the powerless to bring peace. And I'm afraid to say that the reality of his track record is very different from that. But I think a lot of these people, like a lot of very senior politicians, are so imbued in their own hubris that they create almost an alternative reality for themselves, and it's very difficult to puncture that. So I'm very wary of this notion of some arms dealer who at some point might have supported a very genuine liberation struggle, and I was a part of one for many years, in some sense as being seen as good, because there's certainly no arms dealers that I've come across, and Kathy, you might be in a different position, who I've come across who have been driven by ideological motive. And finally, just to say, it is worth pointing out that Charles Taylor, the Liberian dictator, and Sanko, the RUF leader in Sierra Leone, which endured such an horrific civil war at the hands of both Taylor and Fode Sanko, they met and became friends and comrades in Tripoli at Gaddafi's World Revolutionary Headquarters. So while at some level the ideology might have been well-intentioned, its practical consequences were devastating for many human beings. So I'm reticent about identifying arms dealers as playing any sort of admirable ideological role often. I don't know if you have different experience or anything either of you would like to add.
No, I just will say that during the tape transcripts we heard during the Victor Boot trial, the one major complaint Victor Boot had after $6 billion had been frozen, he complained bitterly that $10,000 had been frozen to one particular company. He made an example of $10,000 out of all of his billions. So even that paltry amount meant something to a war profiteer.
Bill.
I had a question for Kathy. The Victor Boot trial, is there another Victor Boot waiting to be prosecuted? Is it a model we can use, or is it sort of unique unto itself?
I think a lot of us who have tracked Victor Boot for years are somewhat disappointed with the way the trial went down. There are still 9 pending counts against Victor Boot, and those 9 pending counts are for actual crimes he committed, everything from conspiracy to money laundering to fraud. They were for his real arms trafficking activities. And during the trial, he was on trial for a sting operation for crimes that had been manufactured. And there's a lot of concern around the way the sting operation itself was conducted. During the sting, which was led by the DEA, the DEA paid former human rights abusers millions of dollars, cocaine traffickers, to actually lure Boot to Thailand, where he was arrested. So it's sort of left a lot of queasiness in terms of how the sting operation was conducted. Unless they're precedent-setting cases against arms traffickers for the actual crimes they commit, which addresses the problem of arms trafficking, in some senses, this is a little bit of a hollow victory. We really need to see prosecutors go after arms traffickers for their illegal criminal activities that are elsewhere. One of the reasons why I think the prosecution was effective with the jury is because Victor Boot stated that he wanted to kill Americans, and this resonated very strongly with an American jury here in New York. If Victor Boot had perhaps threatened to kill citizens in the Congo, Liberia, Colombia, Afghanistan, I'm not so sure that it would have carried the emotional weight with the jury. So again, I think this is why advocates are really pushing for a strong arms trade treaty so that we can criminalize this activity, leave no doubt as to who is operating legally and who is operating illegally, and so that the lawbreakers can actually be tried for actual crimes. There will be no repatriation of that $6 billion funds that have been frozen back to victims or back to affected communities because they had no representation in the trial.
The other thing that would have been of interest to me is any sort of raising of Boot's work with America, with various other governments, even with UN structures in the trial. But I suppose that we need to take victories where we find them, even if they aren't ideal. The lady at the back over there.
Thank you. My name is Puella Lunaris, Artistic Director of Dances of the World Society. Can you address the use of ideologies / religions to justify the industry of war?
I suppose a starting point is a comment made by the industrialist Henry Ford a long time before Victor Boot came on the scene. And he said, show me who makes a profit from war, and I'll show you how to stop the war. And the thing that has really struck me, I come from a highly politicized society. I joined the ANC when I was in my mid to late teens. And the lack of ideology outside of the ideology of convenience amongst both governments and individual arms dealers, as I've done this research now for probably over 10 years, if I include my time working on South Africa, continues to astonish me. There are very few people who are engaged in this out of any sort of ideological imperative. Yes, there are a lot of people who would justify their actions on the basis of ideology, religion, etc., etc. But there are very few for whom this is the driving force. there's the case in the book of an Iranian who worked for the Iranian government as a procurer, but he worked undercover in the sense that he was trying to procure over the internet, which is actually quite easy to do. While I was doing an interview earlier today, the interviewer asked me how much he could get a surface-to-air missile for on the black market. So I had my computer with me, and I just looked it up, and I found one for $38,000, which seemed like a very good deal to him. But the reality is that the vast, vast majority of people I've come into contact with, the Iranian, he worked for his government. It was a job. He was a civil servant. But he realized that this was something that was quite easy to do, so he started trading for himself on the side. He ended up being arrested and brought to the US in another sting operation, not a very well-known one. And he's currently in jail, I can't remember where. And the extraordinary thing is when he got here, he was, of course, he stated that he was trying to undermine his own government, the Iranian government, in support of the US. When his wife gave an interview in Iran, it was about how her husband was a patriot and he was doing his work for the cause of the Iranian government. The reality is he and his uncle, who was also involved in this with him, were trying to make as much money as possible as quickly as possible. And while, of course, there will be people who access arms for ideological, religious purposes, I think the dealers themselves, those actually engaged in the business of war, be it at a governmental level or a gray or black market level, primarily do so for profits. Again, I'm open to correction.
I just keep drawing lessons from the Victor Boot trial. I think I'll be drawing lessons for years to come. But it's very interesting that Victor Boot's co-conspirator, who plea bargained with the U.S. and testified against Victor Boot, was a military intelligence officer for the apartheid government in South Africa previously. And the way that he sold this deal to Victor Boot is, hey, look, we're all in this communist fight together. Victor Boot is the quintessential capitalist. He'd long left communist ideology behind. And yet, communism ideology, if it was a selling tool, everyone was hopping on the bandwagon. So in terms of where the arms traffickers, the dealers are coming from, basically, they'll use any ideological, any religious, any kind of slogan to market their wares.
Please, Jeff. You've taken the hard task of this question as well as the one about when is an arms trafficker a good arms trafficker.
Yeah.
I think it is, we still need to pay attention to where we hear the ideological arguments. And I'll just use, the United States continues to be a major arms supplier to two countries that it takes a lot of flack for, one being Taiwan, one being Israel. And I think whether you call those religious or ideological, I think that those commitments to those countries go back a long way.
Sure.
And are sort of hard to understand today. And I think it's important to remember some of these ideological or religious ideas get carried on and passed on for decades past the point where that decision was made. And I'd say the U.S. with Cuba today is another example of where we see a very old policy that is very hard to reconsider that was made along ideological lines. Undermining it may be nefarious dealers. Undermining it might be undermining is not the right word. Supporting it or buttressing it might be nefarious arms dealers or profit motives. But I think the challenge we have moving forward in the world is whether there are going to be universal things we agree to. And I'll just quickly to turn it back to the ATT. This is where when I talk about the criteria of the treaty, are we really at a point where we agree that human rights abuses should be things that arms aren't sent to those places? And I think we have a very difficult situation with Syria today. Mm. I mean, it's almost unimaginable for me to buy any of the argument that this is an uprising, that these 3,000 civilians that have been killed can be justified in any way. But we still can't get the global community to agree on an arms embargo is a tough sign of whether we're at that point. But we're hoping You know, the UN's founding is now old, and yep. countries have agreed to these principles, and we need to keep working to put those, what can we have these shared values across countries, how can we put teeth and agreement into them? So that's a way to answer both of these questions, and it's not an easy one either. I think we're still trying to figure out if the world is ready mm-hmm. for these things.
Yeah, I just want to add, tracking arms traffickers and trying to bring them to justice, one of the key problems that I run up against is not ideology, but nationalism. And one of the problems of bringing Victor Boot to justice has been that he's sought safety and protection in Russia. One of the reasons why it's very difficult to get certain arms traffickers onto UN sanctions prohibition list is because the five permanent members of the Security Council protect their own. And we have traffickers from the US, from Britain, from France. We've tried to put on, we've identified, we've collected evidence, we've got all the goods on these particular entities. And you have the UN Security Council members themselves protecting their citizens.
I think we probably have time for one more question in just a moment. Do you mind if I go to the gentleman at the back
please.
Who hasn't enough? I was going to make a point on the ideological question, particularly in relation to Israel, but I'll make it informally afterwards, perhaps. The gentleman at the back, yeah.
Thank you. Yes, I'm David Wildman with the United Methodist Church Human Rights Office. And I had one just clarification when you said the $60 billion of the arms trade. Does that include, like, the arms transfers? You mentioned Israel. The U.S. gives quite a few millions and billions in arms trade, and I just wanted some clarity on that. So
this is the figure that is developed by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, which produces mm-hmm. an annual yearbook, which is regarded as the sort of the gold standard of arms trade statistics. But it is only the formal trade. They do try and supplement what is reported by governments with their own research. But my cautions would be that the work is superb that they do. Mm-hmm. But my word of caution would be that they are obviously underestimates, because there's an enormous amount, even of formal arms trading, that is not reported, and it doesn't include the trade in what I've described as the shadow world. Mm.
So, thank you. So my questions were especially around the Security Council members, where you described this as kind of legalized bribery in many cases. What are the incentives for members of the U.S. Congress or other parliaments to really clamp down on an arms trade when there's lots of campaign legal bribes that head in their direction? And the second thing related to this is with the number of the sophisticated weapons that are included or possibly included in the arms trade, there's a lot of companies in the electronics industry especially that, like Hewlett-Packard, is in the top 50 arms contractors, military contractors, but it's not seen as an arms company. And I'm wondering whether, maybe this is like the next book, what efforts have there been to look at the inter-involvement of other companies and other industries in this really mm-hmm. lethal trade?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just very quickly on the incentive to lawmakers in the U.S. situation, it's a very difficult one. And again, I say this as something of an outsider, and while sometimes I don't have the depth of knowledge, obviously, an outside perspective can seem quite obvious to all but the insiders. And the thing that strikes me about the US situation is there are a range of debates from a variety of political perspectives in this country about the issue of fiscal deficits, about broader issues of public spending, but also about accountability and about who is being represented by the current lawmakers. Because the reality is that what goes on in this industry and many others is, whether we like it or not, not only being done with our tax dollars, and I am, since my fellowship, a taxpayer in the US, I remember. So I'm not a taxpayer in three countries, which is very unfortunate. But it's a good thing when you're being interviewed about those countries. but it's also, it's being done in our name. And this is why I say the most fundamental issue, if we are to see meaningful change in the way in which this industry operates at its formal and shadow levels, is political will. And while it might seem an incredibly naive thing to say at this point in our political history, the only thing that really changes political will is when you impact politicians at their bottom line, which is in terms of votes. And as long as politicians feel that this is okay and they can get away with it, they're going to continue to do that. And I say that as someone who spent 8 years as a formal politician. So in Al Gore's terms, I'm a recovering politician. But I think it's incredibly important. And I think we do forget in the global polity that exists today, because the one thing that I find in many of the countries I travel to is this distance between the rulers and the ruled, almost regardless of their political systems, is that we have a responsibility of active citizenship. And you know, when I published my first book that Steve referred to on the South African case, I made the big mistake of speaking to a book club a few days before the book was actually launched. And it was my sister's book club in a suburb of Cape Town. And I read some extracts from this book about the extent of corruption and everything else. And there was one woman who was looking at me very intently. And as I closed the book, she almost shouted out, "Why don't you just get a life?" And I said to her, "Sorry?" And she said, "Just accept that all politicians are corrupt and are always going to be, that all arms deals and many other sorts of deals are corrupt and are always going to be. Go and get a proper job, spend more time with your children, and stop this silly business that you're involved in." And I thought about it. I actually thought about it. Because I had, while I was writing the book, I'd had to spend almost 5.5 years working in a bank to make a living while I was writing the book. And I thought, after that, I'd never get a proper job again. And I eventually responded to her and to many others over the years by saying, "Well, I suppose my options are to go home to my children. I have two kids, one of whom is about to turn 13 and the other of whom is 8. So they were a bit younger. This was 4 years ago. And say to them, look, the world's a bit of a mess. But don't worry about it, because there's nothing I can do about it. And, you know, when you're my age, it'll probably be in a far worse mess. Don't worry about it then either, because there's nothing you can do about it." And I do believe, perhaps naively and idealistically, that it is possible for individuals and groups of individuals to make a difference. And while there have been far more individuals and groups of individuals who have worked towards something and not made a difference, in some ways they are necessary for the others who do make a difference and who do change the course of history. So even if it seems extremely bleak, and I think all three of us sitting here have felt on many occasions over the years as though we are banging our heads against a very stern brick wall, and at least Kathy has some hair to protect hers.
Laugh.
But the reality is that if we're going to give up and say, no, it's okay, the world can stay like this because there's nothing anyone can do about it, then we also have to take part responsibility for the way the world is today.
Before we all go off to get lives, I want to thank Andrew, Kathy, and Jeff for a scintillating evening's conversation, and all of you for coming this evening. And I don't know that I mentioned that Andrew will be signing copies of his book in the hallway after the event. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much, Kathy. Thanks, Jeff. Thank you.